Thanks for having me. I appreciate the opportunity. When I told people what I was talking on, they all said the same thing, which is, what? I guess the title, we'll get into what exactly I mean and what it means for all of us as we go along here. When I was a kid, and I think my daughter just did this, they gave me a test one time in school, and it had a whole bunch of instructions. And the first instruction was, read all the instructions first before doing everything. Then it had things like flap your wings and poke holes in the paper and stuff like that. Then the bottom one said, just write your name on the corner and put your pencil down. And I remember it because I was fortunate enough to actually do it that time, and normally I wouldn't have. But I read through it, and I wrote my name and put the pencil down, and I looked around. There were two other kids in the class, and we were both looking at each other and giving each other the nod while all the rest of them did all the little crazy instructions on it. That's sort of how I feel when I come to this conference. We're the ones who read to the bottom of the sheet and got the instruction, and then you look around and you can see who else is looking around. So it's always a pleasure. Before I really get into this, I want a brief note on hypocrisy. This presentation is full of it, hypocrisy on my part, because I've violated everything I'm going to talk about, every one of them, and I will continue to do so. So this started years ago as sort of a personal meditation. One of the questions is, if we really wanted to, let's say we really wanted to take the Mormon church down. Now, that's not my goal. But if we really wanted to, how exactly would we go about it? I remember seeing a documentary years ago. It was a group of super, super wealthy people. You know, people who made their money from, you know, railroad robber barons and Standard Oil and stuff like that. Their children. And these people were philanthropists. They really wanted to do good in the world. But the problem was, how do you do that and not actually cause problems? You're all old enough to remember the Ethiopian issue in the 80s. People were starving to death. It was awful. And everybody wanted to do things. And there was food aid and all sorts of money was raised and things were sent over. And there was good done. But there was also a crime element that was born afterwards. Because once that aid, that thing that had value was around, then that became a commodity of crime. Also, the other problem is it destroyed the economy. And we still do this today, in the West. We take T-shirts, for example, we donate them to, you know, your local charity. We bundle them up and then drop them in the third world. Well, if you're a T-shirt dealer in the third world, that will kill your economy. You can't run the basics of the economy. And I don't mean an economics lesson here. But the point is that oftentimes our actions have the counter effect of what we want to accomplish. And there are times that you have all seen online or in the real world where those who want to sort of express what they found out about the church or what should be happening are actually pushing more people into the church or sending them back. And I'm as guilty of that as anybody. I mean, we all have been overly abrasive in a way that is counterproductive to our message. I've been asked by people what my family thinks of me. My family basically, and they might disagree with this, but they think I'm a contrarian, and they think I always have been. So they think that this is just another in a long line of, you know, just going against the grain. They're probably right to some extent, and that's okay. I think that, I read years ago, I read stuff and I don't remember where it's from. In the church, we always said I heard a general authority say once, but I can't say that anymore. I read a long time ago, they were talking about projecting people who leave faith basically as a psychological disorder. And they said statistically it pretty much matches that model because so few, if you take a world view of people who grow up in a particular faith, you know, be it Buddhism or Hinduism or whatever, who reject their fundamental myths, not necessarily what they do day to day, but who say, no, that's false. It's outside one standard deviation. It's a small percentage of the world population that does that. And so people were, the author of the paper was supposing that it might be sort of a genetic disorder because, you know, 50,000 years ago on the savannah, to reject your core group's values would have been suicide. But luckily we have that mutation and we have that deviancy and we're able to do it. So I wear that. I am a contrarian. I am an iconoclast. And that's okay. The world needs that. And we'll go through that there's some good to that and some good that we all have to follow. So iconoclasm, the root word is icon. It means to tear down or destroy icons. Here I have Indiana Jones, and we're raiders of the bad ideas for this presentation. So, you know, you've all seen the movie. He's there trying to steal the icon, take it out of the temple. And, of course, all hell breaks loose as soon as he touches that thing. Because ideas tend to be wrapped up, and they tend to be glorified. And like that temple in Indiana Jones, they tend to be put in the center. As a matter of fact, you won't find an icon without finding it wrapped in some sort of temple somewhere. It's usually going to be buried in the heart and soul of that building. The Gnostics, I'm told, way back in the first or second century, used to do a ritual, sort of a dark ritual, where they would take their adherents down into the basement or wherever they'd built their icons. And it was dark, and it, you know, this is before electricity, of course. And then at a certain point, they would reveal the icon. They'd reveal the statue. And what that would give is this sort of quasi-religious, well, not quasi, it's an actual religious experience. But the icon was shrouded and then revealed at the right moment. So the icons become this central element of whatever it is they're building up to. But when you shone the light on them, if you look at the Gnostic, whatever's left of the Gnostic idols today, you're just like, yeah, okay, that just looks like another one. So this is a Greek church. This is a Hindu shrine. And, you know, you can find billions of these around the world, literally. So, that you know, they're all this whole mechanism, this whole beauty and art and everything is built up around these. So the term iconoclasm comes from destroying the idols of the previous regime or the previous generation or the previous whatever. And it happens over and over and over again, and it literally happens. I mean, people really go in and break them down. The word also has a slightly negative connotation today because it implies that you're doing it for its own sake. An iconoclast, like I was saying that my family sort of thinks about me, you just like doing it. You just like breaking down idols. You like to destroy things that are precious and valuable to other people. So there's both a good and a bad element to that. So when I call the presentation creative iconoclasm, I wanted to use the word creative in its root term, which is to create something, to build something. So here's some of our iconoclasts that I found. You know, the world's full of broken idols. And literally, if you go like to Mexico City and dig down, you hit one civilization after the other after the other. We literally build our civilization on the back of the broken idols of the previous civilization. So the good thing about it is it takes that clearing out of the previous bad ideas of the previous structures to build anew. That the ruins are always covered in nature, which is good because life goes on and the world moves forward. We're constantly in need as human beings of refreshing and renewing. You know, a particular note on science, it is built on the idea of iconoclasm. You know, one of the fundamental differences between religion and science is they're both sort of methods of arriving at knowledge. But once religion tends to find knowledge, it tends to iconize it. It tends to dip it in gold or bronze and then say, this is the ideas you cannot touch. The scientific method is different because it has built in the very mechanism to question its own idols. Not that it doesn't have one. I read years ago that they had done a study on paradigm shift. A paradigm shift is when, you know, a huge number of people kind of suddenly, by suddenly we usually mean over 20 years, change views on a particular point of view. And they said in science, the number one factor in fostering paradigm shift was death. That the previous, you know, big players in whatever scientific community had to die because we get stuck on ideas. And, you know, those who were really big Freudians just had to die before the field was ready to move forward away from Freud. So sometimes it's just something that has to happen generationally, which is important for us, and we'll come back to that. So a little note on religion before we really get digging here. I'm not necessarily talking about religion per se, or even Mormonism. It's just, that's what we experience this. You know, we sort of have a duty or a psychological debt to where we came from, and that's where we understand it. But this thing can happen in almost every aspect of our lives, this building of icons, this taking ideas and solidifying them in concrete. And the problem with dogma is, you know, a good idea becomes dogma and then becomes an icon and then becomes something that needs to go to the trash heap. The metaphors literally become concrete. They take these ideas that might have been stories or whatever and then turn them so real that people believe them. You know, I would challenge everybody, not challenge, it's a fun thing to do. Go find yourself a copy of Grimm's Fairy Tales. Not the Disney-fied ones, the real ones, the dirty ones. And because here you have sort of a proto-religion that sort of got swept aside by Christianity, so it never concreted itself. These things all teach a value. Now, a lot of the values have to do with women losing their virginity, but there are still values that this, or don't go in the woods because you're going to get eaten by wolves. You know, things that aren't as important to us today, but both those ideas aren't as important to us today, actually. but they still, those things get then concrete, and then the next generation comes along and takes them as real, and it happens over and over and over again. So the blood of the icons must be spilt. So there is a dark side to this, and I want to talk about one in particular. This is a picture of the Buddhas of, I think it's pronounced Bamiyan. They're in Afghanistan. They were in Afghanistan. And they are very, very tall. You can see the people. There's two of them. Of course, they're very old, so part of them had sloughed off. Here's another picture. And there's a little dude down there. So you can see how tall those were. This is all just natural decay from these carved out Buddhas in these sandstone rocks. In March 2001, if you remember in your Wayback Machine, the Taliban had taken control of Afghanistan. Afghanistan had been left a wreck by, 2,000 years of war. And the Taliban came in, and the Taliban brought order. The Taliban are our enemy, number one, today, and we tend to forget everything has a good and a bad side, where you have just warring warlords all the time and chaos. The Taliban brought order and brought schools and brought structure to the people. And under the decree from Mullah Muhammad Omar in 2001, they dynamited these because they were idols. Luckily, they filmed it for us, so I have a still shot from them dynamiting them. And this is a before and after shot. It's hard to see here, but these are machine guns those guys have. So just the idea of the going from the one side to the other side, and then that structure again that things must be enforced. So why did they dynamite these? Well, idols are against the Islamic religion because it's written in the Ten Commandments that you're not allowed to have any idols, which are written on stone, which are built on stone and put in, you know, parks and courthouses and stuff all over that. You can't have any idols. So the question is then, given this action, which I hopefully you all find repugnant on some level, even though I doubt many of you are Buddhists, you might be, but there's something inherently, even though this is a literal example of iconoclasm, sort of what we are about, there's something sort of spooky and not right about that. And you could say, yeah, people shouldn't be worshiping idols. And if you get with traditional Buddhists, I mean, they worship idols in every sense of the word. You know, they bow down before them. But why is this so repugnant? And I refer here to Moses, I guess. History is never kind to compromisers. Historically, we look back at compromisers with disdain. But the present day is never kind to agitators. So when you become an agitator, when you become an iconoclast, change when it's in process looks like chaos. And we are in our society in a time of great change and upheaval, and no one can see where things are going. You know, people have said this is sort of a second sort of Gutenberg revolution. You know, you take the printing press and it changed everything, and now digital media and access to all sorts of information is changing everything again. But where is it changing to? None of us have any clue at all. We can't see. We can't even predict what products will, you know, from a year from now. You know, go through your cupboards and look at what digital projects you were using 3 years ago or 4 years ago, and everything has changed super fast. So these two ideas of we don't really want to compromise. We want to be the agent for change because that's what history needs. That's what the future needs. But at the same time, there is definitely a wrong way to go about it. And that's it. That we want to be sure that we're not those guys. Because no one thinks they're those guys. Okay. I said history's moved forward by the agitators. You look back to Greek philosophy and all that, and these great ideas that are buried in these subtle agitators, the old Ionian philosophers and those sort of guys who could very subtly question an idea without bringing the wrath of the locals down on them, moved everything forward. And I really think that a lot of people who criticize, say, what we do, say the same thing all the time. People are happy. Why don't you just leave people alone? Or why don't you stick to your realm? I heard on Science Friday yesterday, they were talking and saying, science is over here and religion is over here. Why do you scientists keep going and saying things about religion? Science is about physics. Religion is about metaphysics. Stop making statement about metaphysics. Let me skip ahead and then come back. The problem is there are no blank spaces on the map. This is an old map, and you'll notice that in the middle, there's all these monsters. Here be dragons. No one leaves the map blank. Everyone fills in all the gaps. So the problem is that those who are building icons have never said, hey, we're only over here. They make a blanket sort of statement that covers the entire world. And you have to go in and prove that there are no dragons. Because they have not said, psh, we don't know what's on the other side of the horizon. That's up to the scientists to go figure out. No one ever says that. I want to go back to my views of, I was talking about great iconoclasts, and the world is full of them. And you'll notice that most of them, or a lot of them, become icons. And that's our human tendency. There's something buried in our DNA to build a shrine around any good idea and then say, don't touch it. So somebody who comes along, and if you read like the teachings of the Buddha, he was very iconoclastic. Matter of fact, the last things he did before he meditated under the Bodhi tree and reached nirvana were sort of to break the rules. He drank the milk from the maiden and he ate some food and his disciples abandoned him because he was breaking the rules. And even people who believe ostensibly in no idols have idols. You go down to Deseret Book and they're selling that it's like full of idols. There's no books there anymore. And they, like I mentioned before, they'll sell idols that say don't build idols. So history is about clearing out the old regimes, and that's what we're in the middle of. So this is a very important work that we're about. Human thought rots and decays, and it needs garbage collectors. But the garbage collectors, like I said, are not always honored in their own time. So the rest of my presentation here is really a meditation on, okay, so given all this information, now what do we do about that? How do we go about it? We know there's a lot of wrong ways to do it, and we could probably spend all day just going from person to person to person, talking about all the wrong ways that we've gone about this. But I want to talk on, I think I have seven, because seven is a magic number, seven ways here. Okay, there's my map. So what to do? First of all, you got to pick your fights, but you got to fight. We are in an absolute sea of bullshit. It's all around all the time. And if you go, read a couple of books on skepticism, take a freshman level course in science and actually think about it, you'll just be running into this stuff like nonstop that people have not thought through, that people have not, as a matter of fact, we all partake in it. There's going to be some little thing in your life that you like know is irrational, like some little vitamin you take or some little ritual you do before you exercise. And you know in the back of your head it's irrational, but you like it. But the world is just awash in this stuff. And the problem is it leads to Ponzi schemes, and it leads to fraud, and it leads to waste of time and resource and lives and all that sort of stuff. So there is no lack of opportunity, is my point. Once Sam Harris, the noted skeptic and one of the four horsemen of the apocalypse, was asked, okay, what can you do? What should real people do? Oh, let's say we assume sort of a skeptical worldview. What do you need to do in your life? And one of his points is you need to call out the bullcrap sometimes. And that can be a very judicious thing to do. There's a time and a place for that, and that's what I mean by pick your fights. You don't want to pick your fight with your boss. You don't necessarily want to pick a fight with a drunk. You know, it's just going to get everybody angry. One of the problems we have, given our new media that I referred to, is we all live in echo chambers now. It is so easy in this day and age just to surround yourself with people who believe exactly the same thing you do. And you have to really strive to not do that, because you gravitate towards that. And pretty soon, all of your news is coming from views that are not just like, you know, it used to be there were Democrats and Republicans, but now it can get even more bifurcated and down further and further and further until you can just match somebody up who believes everything you do, and you're just getting that source back. So knowing that effect is out there, sometimes we have to cut through that, and sometimes we have to stand up and say no. And it can be in a very simple way. The last time I went to Sunday school in 2005, the lesson was on Isaac and Jacob. They were the ones who were talking. Now, you know, we have to be careful because we tend to say they, but you know, a Sunday school class of 40 people, there'll be five people talking, and we just naturally project whatever the five people are saying onto everybody else. So it was sort of my last straw, because they were talking about how wonderful it was that he was about to sacrifice Isaac on the altar. And then I raised my hand. I said, if God tells us to kill our children, should we do it? Was the question I asked. And it was in complete sincerity, because it's a good question. And immediately two or three people just jumped right down on me and basically said, you shouldn't ask that question. But then three or four or five more came to my defense and said, no, this is a good question. Because it doesn't take long for living among fundamentalists, like most of us do, before you meet this. Now, the Laffertys, luckily, are fairly rare, but this sort of thinking comes up in all sorts of things. People who have children who can't emotionally take care of them or afford them is that same sort of putting all their chips on the table on something that really they can't back up that bet. But that's a great example of something that's probably not worth your time fighting about, telling somebody they shouldn't have another kid. So know when to walk away and keep your sanity, I think, is an important part of that. Because if you've all probably been sucked into some internet debate where you're just going on and on and on and on, and you keep restating it because you're like, why can't these morons understand? You keep trying to restate it. It's not you. Trust me. So sometimes you just have to state your case clearly and then move on. And I think that's part of that picking the right fights. Because most people will never learn. And we'll talk here in a minute about kind of what makes people learn, but it's not debate. It's not argumentation. And good politicians and good debaters know they're never talking to the guy they're debating with. They're talking to somebody out there who might be ready to listen. And if you get focused on whoever it is you're talking to, when I get into religious discussions at work, when I allow myself to, I'm never talking to the guy here. I'm talking to this guy here who's not saying anything. Okay, so there's my pick your fight. The avatar, you know, when he gets pissed off, he gets really blue and glowy and is ready to kick some can. But most of the time, he's a good kid. Okay, create the positive. I think the unfortunate thing about, let's say, skepticism and atheism and things like that is we've allowed those things to really be defined by our enemies. And they have been defined in negative ways. That's why I bristle whenever there's discussions on Mormonism as a cult, because to even embrace the discussion is to assume some assumptions that you've moved into the court of whoever it is that's talking about cults. Usually, like evangelicals tend to do that, but you've sort of gone to playing with their ball and you're on their court. And that happens to us all the time in a skeptical world, that in order to engage the rest of the world, we sort of allow them all sorts of assumptions. And really, that is a negative assumption about what it is we're doing. And I think some of the people who are better at this, sort of like, I think of a couple examples of people who are really iconoclastic who try to build a positive, like Penn and Teller, the magicians, you know, and they had that show that ran on cable, the bullshit show, where they would go through and talk about different ideas and why they were wrong. But they tend to wrap their discussion, their framework for a hardcore skepticism in like magic and entertainment and make it palatable as opposed to something that's negative. Michael Shermer, the man who wrote Why People Believe Weird Things, started the Skeptical Society, and they have positive talks and things like that to sort of push it as a positive value. Because so often we let the question be a defense. I finally had a breakthrough with a coworker. Who would take me aside all the time. He's one of those guys who sits till the meeting is over, and then, can we talk for a minute? And I would talk with him. And one time he got upset at me, because he said, you keep saying there's no God. I'm an atheist. You keep saying there's no God. And really, I don't really talk about atheism. I tend to tell him I don't believe in metaphysics. That's what I tell him. I don't believe in ghosts. And he says, you are attacking my belief. This is what he said to me. I said, stop. He's an irrational guy. He's very smart. I said, stop and think about what you're saying for a minute. Every time you say there's a ghost, you're attacking my belief system. And he stopped and said, I never thought about it that way. Because they own the discussion. And it's something that we have to work at in terms of framing our point of view in a positive way. And that's been one that's been sort of successful for me, is to say, I don't believe in metaphysics. I believe in the world as we see it. I don't believe in ghosts. Because it's really hard to say, well, I believe in ghosts, even though a lot of people do, that, they kind of understand that point of view. That's something that's not kind of allowed to say unless you're drunk or it's dark or it's scary or you're roasting marshmallows or something. So we know we have that failure of language. So sometimes we have to have demonstration and we have to just show that we're rational and we take time. Now, that's difficult, too, because people will frame out the things we do. That's one of the successful things of fundamentalist religions. They tend to frame behavior in a way that justifies their a prior beliefs. For example, coffee and Mormonism. There's nothing worse about coffee than eating ding-dongs. But Mormons eat ding-dongs. They don't drink coffee. But when you drink coffee, you've already framed yourself as being wicked. So there's unknowing wicked people who haven't joined the church yet, and there's knowing wicked people who are apostates. But you, when you're a fundamentalist, you have to push that line so that most people are the them and there's very few us. I think another important thing in that creating the positive is really focusing on the community. Find something that you believe in and build that up. And that can be done in a lot of different ways. There's a lot of good things out there. But you can focus in on the positive in ways that compete. One of the reasons that churches are so strong and so strong in Utah, Zilf and I found out when we moved to North Carolina, we were out there for a couple years, and we were amazed at how kid-friendly North Carolina was. The reason it was is not that the Mormons and Utahns aren't kid-friendly. It's just that in my opinion, all the energy focused on kids is poured into the church. So when the church doesn't suck all that energy up out of the community, then there are camps and there are after-school programs and there are, a lot more resources for parents there. So if we want to break the backs of those organizations that have monopolized those things, we sort of have to put our money where our mouth is and build the things that we believe in outside of the communities, the fundamentalist communities that control those things. Okay. My next one, I'm a project manager by trade, and one thing we do all the time is called root cause analysis, which is, it's not usually apparent why things didn't work. And we tend to, as human beings, grab onto the immediate problem and not really look at the underlying problem. For an iconoclast, for somebody who's looking at these structures saying we need to change these, you really need to look and see what are the presuppositions that got us here in the first place. This is why debate never works. And I'll give you a great example. The pro-life and pro-choice movement. These guys are talking past each other. You ever heard them talk to each other? They're just not even communicating with each other at all. Because somebody can be pro-life and say, I believe in the sanctity of human life, and someone can be pro-choice at the same time and say, I believe that people have the right to choose that thing. Or put in other words, you can believe abortion is morally wrong and still believe it should be legal for other reasons. And I'm not trying to sway you one way or the other. I'm just saying that the root cause of what they're talking about is never talked about in the debate, because it has to do with the definition of life and choice and social control and all the things that are really going through those people's heads. Actually, they're not going through those people's heads. It's what generated the ideas that are going through their heads are not addressed. So as a skeptic, you need to really focus on and attack the presuppositions. I'm one of those people who studied my way out of the church, kind of. I mean, I read a lot. But it wasn't until I started reading skeptics and people who are attacking Christianity that it really crystallized for me. I mean, I was still going to church knowing everything, every awful thing there was to know about the church. But until those presuppositions that I had on, is faith even a good model for finding knowledge or a way to live your life, until those were questioned, I didn't ever jump, because it's those presuppositions that generate all the stuff. This isn't so true anymore, but it was in the early days. If you took just a couple of presuppositions, just a couple of, propositional statements, and assumed them to be true, then Mormonism made sense. So, we have inductive logic, where we go around and we see clues, and then we draw conclusions from that. We have deductive logic, where we take principles and we deduce things from them. Religious people, Mormons, are hyper vigilant at the second, and they ignore the first. So they become very good deductionists. So they take these principles that they know a priori, that Joseph Smith is the prophet, the church is true, and Thomas Monson is the prophet today. I mean, those are the three things they rattle off. Once you just assume those to be true, then you can go deductively and look at the world and say, well, the prophet said something that wasn't true, but I know the prophets are true, therefore they were speaking with the power, they're speaking as men, science just hasn't justified it yet. They can go through all these things, and these are rational processes. I'm guilty of this, of accusing religious people and Mormons of being irrational. They're not irrational. They're just using these hyper-inflated propositions to arrive at other propositions. And the only reason it's a good point here is you will never cut through that thicket until you can get at those core ideas. And you can't get at that core idea directly. Now, for many people, that inductive reasoning finally kicks in. And you get so many things, on the prophet Joseph, you say, holy crap, this just can't, there's something wrong here. And then you finally have that moment. I think Tal Bachman once said that it was only when he decided the church could possibly not be true. And then it all just crystallized right then. But getting to that point, that proposition, because he had that stuck in his head, the church is true. And for me, the similar thing was, I would study in sort of a lobotomized way. Whenever I would meet anything that looked kind of strange with Joseph Smith, I'd say, well, but the Book of Mormon is there. And he couldn't have produced the Book of Mormon, so the Book of Mormon verifies Joseph Smith as a prophet. And whenever I'd study the Book of Mormon, see, that was crazy, I would say, well, Joseph Smith was a prophet and he produced it. Therefore, the Book of Mormon, has to be true. Because I never really held those two ideas in my head simultaneously. But once one of them fell, then the other one fell readily. But if you were arguing with me about the Book of Mormon, it wouldn't have done any good, because the Book of Mormon was true not because it was true, apparently. It was true because Joseph Smith, the prophet, produced it. So you would have been wasting all your time and energy on something that was so obvious. Chariots and then... Okay. So I mentioned that the early saints had so many indicators. This is a positive thing here. Much of the propositions that Mormonism was built on have gone away. If you would go talk to, say, Heber Kimball or, the Partridge Sisters, they'd say, well, how do you know Mormonism true? They would say, well, they're speaking in tongues all the time, and they're interpreting. The guy was speaking Adamic last night. they would say, and if you read the early, like, Times and Seasons and Evening and Morning Star, they are talking about signs in the stars all the time. Last night there was this big storm in Cincinnati, and that means Jesus is about to come. I mean, the papers are just chock full of that stuff, and you just don't hear that anymore. So that's why there's more and more people questioning, because a lot of those presuppositions have just gone the wayside. And for us, if we can focus in on those sort of in stealthy ways, that's where you're going to have the most fruit. I wanted to throw this one in the middle because it is extremely important that after you move from one fundamentalist sort of way of thinking, you don't fall into another one, because there's something in our DNA that makes us want to do this. And I think you need to question your assumptions all the time. I was at a party a few months ago. I was talking to Nate and some other people, and we were talking about something that happened in the past, and we all said, well, that's the way I remember it. But that might not be right. And somebody else on the side said, oh, you guys must have all read Mistakes Were Made. You know, because normal people don't do that. Normal people don't question their own memories. Until you read enough literature to know that your memories are probably not as good as you think they are, then you realize saying, just having something in your mind that you remember it that way is not good enough. It's helped our marriage because, you know, you argue about it, then we just say, well, we could both be remembering it wrong, and we just move on. So question your assumptions. Because, and I would recommend that book, Mistakes Were Made, but not by me, because some of the research in there is just mind-blowing. There's some other really great books like that. What's the one on eating? I don't know. Mindless Eating is a great book, because it talks about all this research that people do about, like, what they eat. I'll give you an example. They did a study on yogurt. They were trying to test taste some flavors of yogurt. The reason the study is interesting is they mislabeled all the yogurt. So the blueberry was labeled chocolate and on. No one caught it. Because the label was so, tipped your hat. You said, blueberry, this is blueberry, that you're not as smart as you think you are. And you're not as in tune. So they did this whole study in a college on this flavor thing, and only later they realized they'd mislabeled them all. And no one said a word the whole study. So I think some of those things about what our assumptions are and what we know. So you kind of go back and go through that process of saying, well, this is what I know, and this is how I know those things, and be ready to retreat. Okay. Backfill. This one is extremely important, but it can be very difficult. When you go to the dentist, you know, you have a cavity. The dentist cuts out all the rot, and that's what we want him to do. But if you walked away at that point, you would be worse off than you were before you went into the dentist. What the dentist does that's magical is that he fills it in with some epoxy, and then you don't get a cavity in that tooth anymore. So when we go around destroying these beliefs that need to be destroyed, when we go around questioning institutions that need to be questioned, if you just do that for its own sake and you don't put anything else in, what tends to happen is a new cult arises. I've said this to many people. The fear that I have, we're riding on a sort of a wave in human history. We took it up at the Enlightenment, then we pulled it back down, and then we're sort of back into it. Are we just making ourselves ripe for another one to come along? Let me give you the example of Mormonism. There was the Renaissance and then the Enlightenment, which was spurred on by printing and reasoning and scientific method, and humans made great progress. I read that at the time of the founding fathers, or around Joseph Smith's time, only 18% of Americans actually went to church. And one of the great things that happened in America, there's a great thing and not so great thing, one of the great things that happened in America is the people got out ahead of the churches. I mean, they were moving west faster than the churches. They could get clergy out there and build the buildings and set up the institutions. Well, the positive side of that is it sort of broke some of those social bonds where, you know, the tight structural control, which is one of the things that have made America and all the Americas, you know, an exceptional place, because people were free from those old structures, those old controls, and able to innovate. The problem was it made a fertile ground for those who were willing to sort of exploit those things. When the people at the time of the Book of Mormon coming out and today who are schooled in theology look at it, it's sort of kind of laughable. Because, for example, the Book of Mormon addresses theological questions of 1830. So it's very much an 1830 book. But if you do not understand the theological questions, you would not understand that. After I lost my faith, I picked up two books. I picked up one on the history of the church, you know, the church, and I picked up a systematic theology book. And I had always enjoyed religion. I had read the Bible, I'd studied. I was flabbergasted about what I didn't understand. I was flabbergasted at just the basic questions that as an arrogant missionary or whoever I was going in and pronouncing that we had the solution to when I didn't even understand the damn problem. So you have these institutions where that was made available because the churches weren't there to correct that. So it pushed out ahead. So the church was broken down, its negative part, but there was nothing to backfill, which gave opportunity for a rise of a whole lot of funky religions, most of which have died out. And that's what I'm afraid of might be happening again, is if the skeptics and the atheists and the secularists focus in on tearing down the churches, but don't build something in return. I've said the two most important things churches do is they bury you and the three things. They marry you, they bury you, and they birth you. They preside over those life moments. And unfortunately, you know, a conference like this is really good, but if you're sick, you're not here. And we're not helping you out. And we're definitely not going to put you in the ground. So until some of those institutions get replaced, we have opportunity for the churches. And you all went to church long enough to know plenty of people who left the church who came back when some crisis hit them because the church is good at that. And I think the secular society is not so good at that yet. Okay. Nurture some relationships and preserve, in the tradition of bottle, others. I use the example of my mother. I love my mother. My family and I have a great relationship. They're still very much in the church. My mother, I have no desire whatsoever to have her question her faith. It is what she does. It is who she is. They are linked inextricably. And I'm afraid she would be very, very unhappy to leave the church. Now, if on her own she was questioning, I'd be more than happy to try to be her guide through that and to help her through it. But not all people will take to that. And I think we have to develop the emotional sensitivity to realize what relationships sort of need to be preserved at the level they're at. Now, this is a very individualistic thing, and I don't mean to give this instruction for all relationships. This is something that you have to feel in your heart. Because I believe that the world would be a better place were the church not the way the church is today. But that doesn't mean I need to fight that out in every human soul that I meet on the street. And that might be a bad idea. And when I say nurture relationships, I mean there are some ideas you kind of have to plant and nurture like you do a seedling in terms of helping people to realize what they need to find out. And what I look for is that persistent unhappiness. I was never really super happy in the church. It didn't speak to me. It didn't do anything for me. And that goes way back. I remember when I was 9, the first time I heard the story of Noah's Ark, or that I really sort of processed it, I thought, that doesn't make any sense. But I didn't have the cognitive power to realize why it didn't make any sense. So sometimes those ideas are fermenting in long chains. And what we really need to do is realize who to talk to and who not to talk to. Now, some might accuse me here of the ultimate hypocrisy, you know, as I produce this podcast and put it out there. But my defense is that I put it out there, but I don't force it down anybody's throat. It's there. The information is there. But I don't go around telling people they have to listen to it. So the information is out there, and it's readily available. So we have to draw our clear boundaries. And I like to use the stranger rule. This goes for other relationships too, which is, especially when a relationship kind of goes bad, treat them like you would a stranger. You know, if a stranger came in, like you were after work and there was, somebody from India or something, and he started talking about, you know, whatever Hindu practice he's got going on, you'd be like, oh, that's great. You know, you'd feel like you're watching the Discovery Channel or something. You wouldn't be like, oh, that's crazy. You know, and sometimes we do that with the people that we're around. And if we were better at sort of considering ourselves like anthropologists, saying, oh, that, you know, that is weird. That is weird stuff. You know, instead of getting upset about it. And, you know, treat it like you do politics. You know, some things you just don't talk about. And you have to walk away from those. But I think, you know, to my friend at work, you know, who I would say over and over again, I don't believe in metaphysics. I don't believe in metaphysics. I don't believe that, you know, he would tell me about experiences that he had, spiritual experiences. And my response to him would be, I believe that you really had that experience, you know, but I don't think you and I believe it came from the same place. I don't doubt the reality of that experience. I don't believe it came from the same place. And I don't think it's a valid way of evaluating truth out there. You know, and when he pressed, I would say, you know, because everybody in every religious experience has these same sort of things. And what you would have to do, my friend, is to tell me why I should listen to yours and not everybody else's. That's really the question at hand. And when I kept framing it that way in a thousand different ways, then he finally got it. It took him about 6 months to get what I was even saying. Oh, there's our nurturing the relationships. I do think that is extremely important and extremely hard. I could just survey like this wreckage of my own life of relationships. And a lot of them I don't understand. I don't understand what happened. I still don't understand what happened. And I don't necessarily know what I should have done differently. My family and I, they're all very devout and still are, but they're not like dicks about it or anything. They're nice. But we used to, when we got together, we would complain about the church, not in a real aggressive sort of way, just about this, that, and the other, you know, just sort of griping the way people do, like when you go out to lunch with your coworkers. At some point, they realized that I was serious, and what I did is I destroyed our family glue, which was the church. Not the church in that we all like, hey, we all 100% believe everything, but that was just what sort of held us together. The Mormon Brothers, I saw there's an article there in Suddenly Strangers, talk about this quite a bit in their book. It's a good book. I recommend it. But I think in that book, one of their brothers comes to him and says, you ruined all of our family reunions. And we did. My brothers and I, you know, who I love, they really like sports and the church, and I'm not really interested in either. We have nothing to talk about. And so there's this cloud of silence that hangs over every family gathering, of everybody sitting around wondering what to say and what to do. It's tough. And I would say that, you know, based on some of the points I'm saying here, oftentimes it just can't be achieved in this generation. And sometimes our fights have to stretch out. Which is why, you know, sort of my last point here is we really have to keep our eyes on the horizon. I said in the beginning that agitators are never respected in their own time. They're agitators. And compromisers are always respected in their own time, but never historically. And the fight that we are fighting here, which seems so insurmountable. Because of the podcast, I go to church every 6 months. I go to the priesthood session. And I'm blown away every time when I go into that stake center, knowing how many stake centers I pass on my way to work, how many people are there. It is just crazy. But, you know, and you multiply that over and over again. And it can be depressing thinking there is so much power. 4 months ago, I had a clean computer, you know, because computers do predictive analysis now. So if you think, like, you type in, like, Mormon, and then all these ex-Mormon sites come up that you're winning the battle, I got news for you. That's based on your search. So if you get a clean computer and type in Mormon, and it's also based on Salt Lake City or wherever you're searching from. But I got a clean computer. It was at work, and I thought, oh, great. So I went over to iTunes, and I typed in Mormon. And my podcast came up third, and John DeLynn's came up fourth. So, but there's a shadow to the story. The church got wind of that about 3 months ago. They flooded iTunes with podcasts. We're like 15th now. So they can just, my operational budget for Mormon Expression is less than I gave in tithing the last year I went to church. And that was one guy. Multiply that by all the millionaires and billionaires and stuff. The machine that we are up against is so daunting. Sometimes people ask me, you know, do you worry about the church? You know, because I've not been excommunicated. I'm still a member. Do you worry about the church, like, hunting you down? I'm like, oh, they're dealing with pedophilia stake presidents and stuff like that. I am so far down on their radar list. I'm just such a blip, which we can actually use to our advantage. But, I mean, you look at the number of people here, and what is amazing is the disproportionate influence our voice has given our bodies. Because like I said, that stake center down there in Lehigh had 6 times as many people that are here. I can tell you we're agitating them a lot more than those guys down there. It's probably a good thing they shouldn't be agitating. So we have to have our eye on the horizon that we are involved in a long-term affair. And I think for those of us who've given up the idea of the afterlife, this becomes very important. Because all of us, even if you believe in the afterlife, that's going to be something else. That's not this life. You know, if Newton was resurrected, he sure as hell isn't doing anything to help us out down here. So we borrow consciousness for a short time, a very short time. And what's most important is not what anybody has done, but this stream of humanity that we were able to dip our toes in for a few short moments. And we live in a consumptive culture where everything is encouraging you just to consume all the time. Now, don't get me wrong. What did you call yourself? A rational hedonist? I don't know. You know, I'm a hedonist, but none of that. Oh yeah, sure, whatever. It's okay to consume, but it's very easy to where all you're doing is consuming. And unfortunately, even like reading, like you could read philosophy for the rest of your life and all you would be doing is consuming it. So I think for those of us who've sort of given up the long term, that I'm going to live forever and all that sort of stuff, we sort of have a duty to contribute to the stream because that's really the only thing that will survive. And if you look back, that is what has been of value. That is what has moved us along. You know, that's what we really build ourselves on. There's some of my conservative friends. I was in a debate with one a while back, and he was talking about, he was having a superior air as to how much America is superior to Africa. We were talking about Africa. And we got talking about wells. And, you know, and he was making this point, and I sort of bought into it for a minute, you know, saying, well, you know, in America, we took the initiative ourselves to go build the wells, you know, to get the water. And to build the dams and to build the roads. And he was going on about this. And then I said, well, you know, that's a good point. And then I got home, I realized, I've never dug a well. I've never paved a road. You know, I can do all these sorts of things. There's police protection. There's road. There's all this stuff that I can take advantage of. I can go start a business because all this stuff has been put in place. But other people in other countries don't have that infrastructure. They're starting from behind. Now, what reasons that is a discussion for another day. But we are all part of that stream, and so what we need to do is build wells, dig wells for the next generation. So a lot of these debates, I sort of hinted at, the debate oftentimes is not about who you're talking about. It's who's listening over here. And for a lot of years, I participated on the, I used to argue on the MAD boards, the apologist boards. And what a lot of those apologists never realized is I was never talking to whoever I was talking to. I knew that there were thousands of people who'd come in and read those threads. And that's who I was always talking to. And they would get, you can tell because they'll start like attacking your person and stuff like that. And once that starts happening, you realize they have forgotten who they're talking to. They're talking to everybody else. And the sort of the work that we do here and the structure that we build here is for this next generation that's coming along. Those who have made the biggest changes in the world have seldom enjoyed the fruits of those changes. That's just the way it is. Very rarely does an inventor of something ever get rich off it. It's who comes along and sort of exploits it. And I mean exploit in the most positive way. So you know, artists and authors who've never realized that success, because oftentimes good ideas are not apparent. I've come back to that point several times, that the sort of arguments that we make that are rational, that can rationally dismiss the underlying structures of the church, can't be grasped by those who have been sort of schooled in the church and make all those assumptions. But the kids can understand it. And they are coming along on the backside, and they're figuring that stuff out. So what we do about our children is much, much more important than what we do about our parents. So when I go back to my sort of nurture those relationships or bottle or preserve those relationships, because you're not likely to make a lot of grounds there. But the next generation is where things will matter the most. So we really need to keep our focus on that. And it's hard not to get discouraged that way. But that change comes about because of those agitators and those who did things in simple ways. All right. So those are sort of my seven principles. But I want to circle back and talk about Mormonism a little bit. I've mentioned it. You know, the church is a corporation that would be a people. And it's hard because they try to play all sides. Now, this ultimately backfires on them. Let me give you exactly what I'm talking about. The term Mormon and the term anti-Mormon. The church runs itself as a corporation. It's okay. I don't have any problems with corporations per se. And that's the way they operate. If you look at that paradigm, you can understand that. But they also want to be a religion. That's okay. Religions are out there. They also want to be a people. But they want to shift between the three as they will. So knowing that, we need to address it in those realms, and that goes back to where we have to be careful in terms of that sleight of hand trick they use to use the term anti-Mormon to equate it with anti-Semitism, especially when you're doing something like attacking a corporate tax policy or something like that. Okay, so the church has its different facets, and they use those very cleverly. And it's a trick that's used against us all the time, and we have to be very careful with it. And that's why the voices from the inside sometimes can make more difference. Because, you know, when people ask me if I'm a Mormon, it's a difficult question to answer. But luckily, I can use the same trick they use, and I can choose whatever answer best suits me. But the one thing about the church, knowing the way they operate, and knowing they operate as a corporation, and understanding from that point of view better equips you to deal with what's going to be coming at you. But all in all, Mormonism is not that special. And we sometimes are guilty of the sin of making it that very special. What's going on in the church today is really a trend of what's going on in churches all over the world today in the industrialized world. And, you know, the threats that the church is facing in terms of faith come just as strongly from people who were never members of the church. So given that I said, you know, the Mormon church is so big, we need to not let that get us down. The Mormon church tends to be 30 years behind, and it tends to follow those social norms. So if we adopt that same 30-year horizon where we're looking at our children and our grandchildren, then we'll do better to aim at that and grab those things before they can. My final words, and then we can open this up to discussion. What you are doing in any little way is very important. And I hope the things that I've said today don't make you feel discouraged, like there's nothing we can do, that it can't be done, because it can be. And every single little person, and we're all little people, is important in this. We need to not remain neutral. And if I've implied that, then I've misstated, because it is very important that when the time comes for us to speak up, we speak up. And when people need to know, it's sort of like the issue on gay rights. You know, you don't necessarily want to go around like screaming that all the time, but it's good to let people know where you stand. And they know they can't say certain type of jokes. And I think the model for this is sort of the way racism in the United States has gone. That there are still racists, and there will always be racists with us. But it's not tolerated anymore. And, you know, if you try to give a really racist joke at work, people will jump on you. And we have to sort of follow that model and do it knowing we're in the minority in a way that's as tolerant as possible. I think we need to not passively accept the status quo. A podcast we did last week was with Chuck Burrow. He is an atheist who still goes to church. But, you know, he told a story. He's in California about Prop 8. And he's the chorister. And somebody gave him a bit of testimony. It was a testimony meeting, wasn't it? And was given a tirade about Prop 8. So he just got up and walked out. And he wasn't offensive. He wasn't, you know, he wasn't going to tolerate it. And he said afterwards, many members of the ward came to him and said, you know, we don't believe in that either. You know, they understood his gesture. So those sort of gestures are the kind of things we need to model. The church teaches that there is this basic fight, Star Wars-esque, between good and evil. That good and evil is battling out. They're right, there is a fight, and there always has been, but it's really between freedom and exploitation. That when I talk about idols, what happens is there might be a good idea, but that when I showed you the sanctuary that's built around it, that sanctuary then gets used to exploit people. And that's the problem I have with religion. I know I've been very negative about religion in this discussion, but it's not religion per se. It's these techniques they use to control and manipulate. And the institutions, and that be political institutions or corporations or churches, they get their own, I was going to call it a soul, but they have no soul. But they have their own desires, and those things want what they want. They function almost like organisms. And the individuals are secondary to those institutions. And the problem with those idols is they fuel those institutions, and they use people up. A conversation that Zilf and I had with a relative a few years ago where she was telling us, this is a year or two after we left the church, that we weren't happy. And we're like, what are you talking about? We got more money. We're happier. Our relationship's better. You know, our kids are doing well. Everything's great. And then we said, and, you know, you don't really get along with your spouse. You got this problem. You hate this. You hate this. She said, well, you just haven't learned what real happiness is yet. So they will literally, once that shrine is built up, that's what it is. So this church makes you happy, even if it makes you sad, because that's what happiness is. And those are the things that we ultimately need to battle. So it is, in a way, it's a battle between, like I said, freedom and exploitation. It's a battle between the simple and the complex. Because for religions, they simplify everything with those icons, with those institutions, and they give these black and white answers. And then you find out you're always saying, well, things are more complicated than that. So that's really where we have to go, is sort of decomplexifying that complexity and moving against those simple ideas. Well, that's what I prepared. So I told you this is my meditation and my thoughts. Let's get the microphones, and let's hear what you have to say.
I'm an iconoclast. I'm also a clinical social worker.
Yes, sir.
And I think it's a complete rationalization or intellectualization to believe that the Mormon church cult should not be taken down, attempted to be taken down. Of course, that's unrealistic that it would happen, but to be kept under control, maybe that's a possibility. The Mormon church cult is the worst. It shouldn't be thought of as a church. It's the worst cult that I have ever experienced. It's the most masterful piece of applied psychology I have ever witnessed in my life. And to cite as an example, when you say that something worse might take its place, you know, Jim Jones' followers, almost 1,000 of them, gave up their lives. But when it comes to Mormonism, millions of Mormons have given up the ability to think for themselves. And that is virtual slavery. And if anybody can tell me that there's something worse than that, I'd like to know about it. Thank you.
Yeah, I'd like to talk a little bit about the idea of bringing the church down. I was having a conversation with somebody a couple weeks ago, and I was saying, yeah, I think the heyday of the church is over. I think it's running into some real problems. He said, really, when do you think the church will disappear? I said, in about 400 years, because the religions don't just go away. And, you know, if anything, like the Shakers taught us, is as they diminished in population, they increased in financial power. any real, in my opinion, any like real change in the church, like let's say the church suddenly embraced homosexual marriage, it causes a schism is what it would do. And the conservatives would go this way and the liberals would go this way. But that wouldn't be resolved on Thursday. I mean, you're talking literally hundreds of years. And I think your point that the church, that, you know, churches, the Mormon church is fascinating, a study in like evolutionary psychology in terms of organizations, because they try things that don't manipulate people. And then they don't work. So they go to things, and it's an unknowing system. It's an unmoved mover. There's a ghost in the machine. And it's just sort of the same evolutionary principles. So it is a fascinating study that way. And, you know, we sort of have to be aware of that and sort of break down those underlying structures.
An observation and a couple of questions. One is, I was recently reading an article in the Gawker about Mitt Romney and his impact on Christianity, Mormonism, and the fact he's running. And I don't know if people know that, but his approval rating is between 20 and 25%, which is the lowest ever at this stage of a Republican nominee process, since he's considered the front runner. I know Herman Cain's kind of popping up in the polls a little bit, but, you know... this article basically said that he's causing a lot of Christians, fundamental Christians, charismatic Christians, to look at, because they do consider Mormonism, a lot of them as a cult. That's what the way the Baptist class, you know, have defined it in their dogma. And there was the title of the article was "Jumping the Shark." Has Mitt Romney jumped the shark? And it goes on to say, the problems that are poised, and if everyone understands jumping the shark, that was the storyline runs out. There's nothing more to push the story forward, and so writers come up with creative devices like they did with Fonzie on Happy Days, where he jumped the shark while he was water skiing. Now, it was such an implausible thing. Everyone said, oh, the story's over, because Fonz was such a cool guy, he would never do that, right? And Christians are saying, well, we can't believe in Mormonism because it's so bizarre. You know, you become, you know, a god, you have your own planet, Jesus came to, visit the Indians in North America. And then what it does is it causes them to look at their own religion saying, well, what we believe is pretty ridiculous too, you know. A guy was buried, you know, for 3 days, dug himself up, you know, and then he went out and, you know, went up to his god. And so it's creating all kinds of, challenges. So that's my observation. I'd like to hear what your thoughts are about it. It's really like, what is the impact that Mormonism is going to have kind of on the psyche of Christians? And the second one is, since I'm not an active member, I really don't talk to Mormons. I live in Oregon. I was just curious, what do members believe? What do they think? And I know that a lot of them are feeling a lot of anxiety about Romney running because it's creating this huge spotlight on Mormonism. So I'm curious, you know, from your point of view, you know, how is this going to impact the church and, you know, and people's belief and understanding?
I'll address your first issue first. We had on the podcast a year ago a friend of mine. We called him Joe. He was a Jehovah's Witness, and he left the faith. And the way he left his faith is he read Fawn Brody, "No Man Knows My History," and he said, "This is crazy." And then he said, "Wait a minute." that's what jarred his faith. And I do think, to your point, I think some of those, I scratch my head at a lot of the evangelicals. I have evangelical friends, and a lot of the evangelicals, you know, will digest my podcast and stuff, even though I'm probably more hostile towards evangelicals than I am Mormons. But that, you know, sort of that, my enemy, whatever. Yeah, I think you're right. I think some of those weapons they're trying to form against Mormonism will backfire on them. And it's where I was talking about that last point. There's a bigger trend of skepticism and humanism in the world today that we're seeing. And I think a lot of Americans are going to be like, what? You know, what? Why are you even attacking that point of view? It's sort of reminiscent of the old Kennedy years. As to what Romney will do, I think most mainstream Mormons are rah, rah, go, go, because they think they're right. And there's a lot of them, you know, 20% still believe in the white horse prophecy, who the Constitution will hang by a thread and the elders of Israel will save Zion and the sacredness of the Constitution. And they do, but generally, politically, Mormons in high office has paid off. Now, my opinion is, although I don't necessarily agree with Romney's politics, I think it'd be wonderful from my point of view if he gets the candidacy, because this burning hot spotlight is going to go right down on Salt Lake City. And you and I have all read these stories where the reporter from the Post or whatever asked him about the church, and Otterson gets up there and says, "We do not have anything to do with polygamy." And they like say, "Okay," and they move on. You know, and I think that those sort of shell games they play about, you know, the curse of darkness and polygamy, where they say, "We don't have anything to do with this." I think when there's a longer cycle, if there's a president, presidential candidate or a president, there'll be plenty of time for people like Krakauer to come in and really dig underneath the, what that will do is it'll reform the church. The church will, in my opinion, this is just me talking, the church will follow whatever Romney says. If he has the presidential candidate and he says, this is only a practice, not a doctrine, it will immediately become a practice, no longer a doctrine. Because the church is run by businessmen. I mean, and they are floundering. They have no idea what they don't know doctrinally what to do anymore. I mean, that's obvious, isn't it? Isn't that clear? I mean, I think they believe it. I mean, there's people in this room who would argue with me about that, but, and I just think they don't know what's going on. They don't understand it. So that would be my opinion of what will happen. So go Romney. Probably not. You know, there's a old joke I heard in business school. Two economists meet each other at the polling station. And one says, "I won't tell anybody you were here if you don't tell me I was here." So that's sort of my attitude about voting. But where's the?
Oh, hi.
Howdy.
About another comment, Julia Sweeney, she talks about in her performance that she left Catholicism after she got tracked out by some Mormon missionaries and realized that the things in Catholicism were equally wacky, and so there's that. Also about Mormonism and the cult issue. I think when Joseph Smith's time, it was probably more of a cult. Now it's kind of a mishmash, depending where you are and whether you're in a small town or not, things like that. But Sam Harris, in his book The Moral Landscape, talks about trying to evaluate things based on whether they promote well-being of people, and I think you can do that with all religions. How well are they helping people? How much are they damaging people? And there might arguably be even more damaging religions even today, but maybe that's another discussion. But in any case, lastly, you said you liked Penn and Teller, and Penn Jillette has talked about an advocacy for speaking your mind and not, you know, basically not hiding what you think. And so maybe one analogy is on Facebook. You can say what you're doing, what you think about things, and if your TBM relatives still want to be your friend, then fine. If they don't, then, you know, too bad. But don't hide who you are as a, you know, or what your journey is.
Yeah, I agree with that. I try to sort of live out loud, but not in their face too much, sort of thing. So I'll post more bombastic things in like groups than I will on my own thread. But I do put articles about atheism and stuff up. I never said I'm an atheist. I guess if you look down in my religion, it says like Mormon atheist or something like that. But oh yeah, it does. It says meh now. That's what it says. But as to the cult issue, I will say this. I think it's really a loaded word, and you can talk about organizations being psychologically healthy or unhealthy. And if you take a traditional definition, the traditional points of a cult, the MTC is a cult. They require you to dress a certain way. They don't want you to use your name. They don't want you to contact your family. You know, they keep somebody with you all the time. But is the Fairfax, Virginia Second Ward a cult? Okay, probably not. You know, so I think there's some, because of their psychology, can thrive in that situation. Hell's bells. There's some people who thrive in, like, you know, an MBA program, and others would be like, this is culty, because it's the way their psychology is. So I think the church is healthier for some people than others, but there's definitely some unhealthy elements all the way around about it. So I would say, in terms of unhealth, it's an unhealthy organization.
The underwear.
The underwear. Yeah.
Hey, John,
yes.
I've never heard of your podcast before. I like the way you articulate, and I'm going to start listening. You're able to express yourself, I get, much better than I can, because I get so emotionally charged that I can't say anything. And one of your comments you said earlier was not to remain neutral, and I think this gentleman touched on it just briefly, but I am from Salt Lake City, and a lot of my friends and family and coworkers are LDS, and I'm friends with them on Facebook, and they are always saying, you know, the Mormon Church is Christian, you know, look at the Book of Mormon. They're always putting this ultra-conservative, right-wing Christian views out there, and I want to challenge them, but I don't know how to do it. Do you have any suggestions? Because I've just been ignoring all their Facebook comments, and because I don't know what to say. Do you have any suggestions?
Well, I'll give two. One we had from last week, and I actually posted this on Facebook because I thought it was funny. We were at our parent-teacher conference, and the teacher was saying, you know, I don't give homework on Monday. And Zilf and I both smiled and nodded. And he said, you know, on Monday. And we just smiled and nodded, because that's Satan's plan. And we both just smiled and nodded, because it's her fourth grade teacher. He's a nice guy. I'm sure he's a decent teacher. You know, he talked about his teaching methods. To my daughter, that's all just imaginary stuff, you know. So it's just, I could have been like, you know, then people post that. Does this guy, did you demand his job? It's like, oh, geez. I mean, you know, it was sort of an innocuous thing, but it's just like, do I have to hear this all the time? But so I went and I put it on Facebook, and that was cathartic, right? And I think to the Facebook thing, I think sometimes the best way is not to challenge what other people are doing, but do similar things. You know, saying, you know, I was at this protest, or, you know, I was at a PFLAG meeting, or I was doing this sort of thing. So passively, because we have a tendency to say, I am not going to share my stuff because I know it's offensive to other people. But if you sort of model the way they do it and passively just throw it out there, then they're going to know who you are. And what you're going to find out is that you have more allies than you thought you did. It's like in church. I would dare say the minority of Mormons are really like Glenn Beckers. The church is full of people sitting there thinking, oh, this is lame. But they don't have any allies. The church is very effective at shutting that sort of discourse down. So if we can sort of put that out there, wear sleeveless tops. I mean, that's a great metaphor for you know, for living your life, because they immediately say, oh, you know, just like I look for that seam. You know, why does that seam so high? We should have a course in garment spotting. It's my favorite thing to do at, like, Disneyland and stuff. You know, we were there a couple. Oh, look, there's one. All right, thank you.